since you came along, you sex a thing.
Hey folks, I'm David Goldstein.
And I'm Brian Brinkman.
You are tuned in to episode 11 of Beyond the Pond. This is the podcast in which Brian and myself utilize the music of Phish as a method to introduce the listener to other jam, to other non-jam bands that would think that they might like. We love Phish. We are big Phish fans, especially now as the Baker's Dozen is going on. But the problem with Phish fans is that really, they listen to nothing but Phish. They become myopic, and then their life just goes down a dark path. And we don't want to see that happen.
So this is our 11th episode. We are going to do something slightly different here. We've been doing something slightly different our last few episodes, but keeping with that, we are going to cover two jams from the Baker's Dozen. We decided to go ahead and cover a couple different jams from the last the first eight shows of the Baker's Dozen. We're going to go ahead and talk about The Tube from Wednesday, July 26th. And the song I heard, The Ocean Sing, from Sunday, July 30th. Two really fantastic examples of the diversity jamming and the depths that Phish is going with their improvisation right now.
So some of the themes that we're going to explore via these two jams in this episode include Madchester jams. As Manchester in the summer of 1988 called Madchester, which you will soon learn about. Midtown UFOs. And what the hell is happening at the Baker's Dozen? My God. But on that note, let's get to the Phish.
An asteroid crashed and nothing burned. It made me wonder, do tigers sleep in lily patches? Do rhinos run from thunder? I gotta make it my left ear. I felt the spirit, but I still can hear. It made me think I would not be burned. But I didn't give myself to science. I felt that I could.
All right, so like we mentioned at the top, we're going to cover two different jams in this episode. First up is The Tube from Wednesday, July 26, 2017, followed by the song I Heard the Ocean Sing from Sunday, July 30th, 2017. But before we get into those, we wanted to just kind of talk about why we picked these two jams. I would say, first and foremost, these are both really incredible examples of the diverse jamming that Phish has really been experimenting with throughout the Baker's Dozen. If you think back to the first weekend, three really solid shows. I think we would both agree they're at the very minimum B-rated shows, but B-plus, A-minor shows to kick off the Baker's Dozen after a really great five shows that came from Chicago and Dayton and Pittsburgh. But I think if there was anything left on the table or anything left to be desired during that weekend, there was a lot of Bliss Peak jamming. And we all know what happened following that first weekend. Everyone was really high on where Phish was. And then, what was it, like an hour after the 7:23 show ended, they announced the jam-filled donuts for 7:25. Is that correct?
I don't remember if it was an hour. It was certainly early that morning. Certainly. I agree that the first three shows, of which I saw the first two, were all B-plus, A-minus shows. Very, very good. Very solid 2017 excellence. They would all be near the peak of what transpired in 2016, but they had yet to drop the hammer, so to speak.
Right.
Like, I left those shows thinking, okay, they're getting there. They're feeling it out. They're seeing what they can do. Very satisfying jamming. And then Tuesday hit,
and I won't forget it. I was texting with you, Dave, as well as two of my other buddies who were at the show. All of us went in with pretty big expectations. We all know that expectations can be the death knell of Phish fans a lot of the time. And so when the band opened up with Sample, you could literally hear the band and nothing else on the stream. It sounded as though they were playing in an empty room. And then right after the, there was the second chorus and sample.
Right after the Simple Smiles and Good Times Seem All Wrong,
Trey just took the song in a completely new direction, and we got our first 10-minute sample, followed by, and I can't believe these words are coming out of my mouth still, a 29-minute and 59-second version of Lawn Boy.
Yeah, that was, I was at that show. I actually wrote about it for Fishnet, and then when they started the sample, like letting an air out of the balloon, then when they started the jam, it was like everyone saying at once, okay, I see what's happening here. And then Trey had a huge shit-eating grin. I mean, people, you know, until with Lawn Boy, I mean, people didn't really realize the magnitude of what was going to happen, and still Fishman started playing the drum beat. At that point, it all settled in, said, okay, they're trying to go epic. They're well aware of it. They're calling their shot. Jamfield's got nothing to do with Raspberry. It has to do with the fact that they just decided to pick this night to go big. And all of the stuff leading up to it, like the 27-minute simple from Chicago, the big Wombat Jam from Dayton, the 17-minute MoMA Jam a few nights prior. You know, this was all dry runs for what ended up being one of the more epic nights of Fish 3.0, if not the most epic night. It's certainly, at this point, it's between that and then the Fuck Your Face show, 8/31/2012.
Yeah, I say you throw a bit of Magna Ball in there and you've got maybe that night three at Randall's. You've got a pretty good argument for high-level, high-quality Fish and 3.0. But, you know, in regards to this tube, and all of this, we haven't even mentioned the, I think perhaps my favorite night or my favorite jam of the 7/25 show was the big Cross-Eyed and Painless. Your first, which was really cool to know.
Yes, yes. I was very, very excited to see that. Yes.
But following all that, you know, I would say most people would have forgiven Fish if they had come out and played a complete dud on Wednesday. They came out and they had a somewhat standard first set that sounded really, really good on re-listen. I actually really enjoy that first set, but Tube came around to close out set one and really picked up that experimental jamming from the night before, and feels in some ways as though Tube is back as a big jam vehicle. I mean, this was their most experimental version since 2.0, thinking about 2.22.03, as well as I believe it was 6/24/2004. I think that was the night.
Yeah, easily the best version of Tube of Fish 3.0. I don't think that's up for debate.
No.
And you know, the jamming we'll talk about where in relates to the songs I pick for this episode going forward, but certainly that was a great way to end that set. That set had a Pebbles and Marbles in it, which was very good. It had what the Very Long Fuse was quite nice. Even
yeah.
Farmhouse, the place, was pretty good. I mean, it was certainly, whereas the night before, obviously, I mean, the first set had a 30-minute Lawn Boy. I mean, you can't expect that level of improvisation every night. But no, I thought that the first set on that Wednesday, July 26th show was good. It was kind of felt like a cuddle, like you're after whatever's gone on in the sheets, being 7/25, 7/26 is the cuddle and watching television and eating ice cream in bed afterwards. Kind of, you know.
Well, it's also kind of what are you supposed to do after
right.
play a 13-song show? And
you come out and you sing Fleet Foxes a cappella and play Cars, Trucks, and Buses in My Soul.
Say,
all right.
There you go.
And that was great. And that makes perfect sense that Trey would discover the first Fleet Foxes record now, because it came out in 2008. And Trey and indie rock, it takes a few more years than most people.
So, you know, with regards to the Tube, and we'll talk a bit about the jamming style here shortly. Later in the show, we're going to talk a little bit about the song I heard, The Ocean Sing, that was played on Sunday the 30th, which will be the second jam that we're featuring. But In terms of the overall significance of these shows, of this run, what is your kind of quick take on the Baker's Dozen, where we are right now, 8 shows in?
It's exceeded my expectations.
Has it?
I think that, yeah, it has. First of all, the establishment of the whole, like, donuts theme. I mean, I think at first when they announced that they'd be handing out donuts for every show, everyone thought it was cute. And then when they saw it, the first one would be coconut, they kind of didn't realize that the coconut theme would be incorporated into the show.
Right.
And then once they realized that coconut donuts meant things like playing Reba and having, like, coconut-themed cover songs. And it was great because every time there was a new donut flavor, it would cause more speculation on the internet, more things to talk about with your friends, more songs to guess, and just, you know, kind of like really brought the Phish community together, and it was a lot of fun, kind of reflective of some of the more zany aspects of the 90s. And the shows have been jam-packed. They've been loose. They've been very good. I mean, I think almost any one of the shows might have on its own been an argument for, like, a top 5 show of 2016. And certainly, in terms of ranking all the shows, I think that the first and second would have to be probably Night 4 and Night 5, both of which, in addition to being the best shows of the Baker's Dozen, could be top 10 shows of 3.0.
Yeah, I would say the only other show that has a that could kind of sneak into that top 2 would be Sunday Night.
Yeah.
Which I was at, and just kind of had all the makings of a classic Phish show in terms of big old songs, rarities, storytelling, and then a 40-minute jam segment to start the second set that really, you know, took that experimentation that you saw in 725 and 726 and kind of seem to find the outer edges of it and then keep going. As we're talking about this, I do have Twitter going next to me, and Scott Marks Biz Archive is freaking out because Steep just crossed 11 minutes. So that kind of speaks to where we are right now in terms of the Baker's Dozen. I would agree with you completely. This has far exceeded all of my expectations.
Yes, I too have received a text message from somebody at the show saying they have played many of my least favorite Phish songs. That said, this is very, very good. Referring to the, I guess at this point is probably the 12 minutes deep. But just to pick up on what you were saying, yeah, the most recent Sunday Night show, if you told me that the show would feature Forbin's Mockingbird with Squirming Coil lyric teases, and a harpua, and 40 minutes of spaceship ambient jamming to kick off the second set, then I would say, wow, that sounds like one of the greatest shows of all time. And it may end up being that, because that was a very, very high quality show.
It was. And just kind of running through some of the highlights. You know, we all know them, but starting with weekend one, as Dave was saying, this really established the donuts theme and the impacts that they would have on the overall shows and the overall run. Timber modulated into a jam 3 songs into the entire run. We got Tweezer, Slave, and Reba off the table immediately. For those of us who thought they were doing no repeats, this was a big blow to our argument and also seemed like a ballsy move by the band. You had Great 7 Below, really great second, Everything's Right, both of which jammed pretty heavily. Next night you got MoMA Dance, Breath and Burning, had big jams during the first set, followed by a Down with Disease jam and reprise in set 2. Really great peaking jam out of Down with Disease, and Strawberry Letter 23. Also an acapella Strawberry Fields opener, which pretty special way to start the show, and Peaches and Regalia in the encore for the first time ever. And then just wrapping up that first weekend, Sunday Morning by Velvet Underground opened the show. 15-minute It's Ice and a very, very, very mellow but ambient jamming set 2, with Wolfman's Twist and Waves really being the peak of all of that.
And then the first week, those Tuesday and Wednesday shows, of course, they had the release of the Jam-Filled Donut theme that Monday morning. And then you know that show had your just your typical 10-minute sample in the jar, 30-minute Long Boy, the 12-minute My Friend, My Friend. They also played Type 1, a very satisfying Stash and Bathtub Gin in that set. Set 2, You Should Not Sleep on the Fuego, just 20 minutes and quite good. 33-minute Crosshead and Painless, and they even did the debut of the song End of Session, which is the last song in Story of the Ghost that I didn't even realize Phish considered to be an actual song, but I guess they had a change of heart. That was quite good and quite interesting. Now, the next night, Wednesday, July 26th, they had the 15-minute 2, which we're going to talk about, and Set 2 is a fully flowing machine, going from the Carini to the Mystic Completely into a very shaggy but Dance Party USA version in 1999 that had an extremely high energy jam, steamed No Quarter into Character Zero, which featured a very cute Mike and Trey duel, and of course the encore of Neil Young's Powderfinger, which is one of the greatest songs of all time, was played very well and fit perfectly in with the powdered donut theme of that evening.
Picking up right there, Dave went off to vacation and I headed to New York City.
Broadcasting live from Cape Cod.
I got up there for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Really, you felt that the band was settling into the residency in a sense. They're playing more songs in these sets, but still really high quality jams and a few gags. The one thing that really blew me away from the weekend was while we didn't have quite the surprises in terms of first set jamming that you had in the first five shows, aside from Sand and a brief jam out of Wilson and Runaway Jim on nights 7 and 8, when they started up the second set with a particular song, the combination of no repeats, whatever history you had with that song from a jamming standpoint, it was as if the crowd just completely locked into it. I don't know the last time I've heard a Phish crowd as loud as they were when they started Chalk Dust Torture on Friday night. It was just as though everyone realized, all right, this is the Chalk Dust Torture of the run. We know that they've jammed this incredibly well over the last 5 years. You could argue in a lot of ways it's been their best and most reliable jam vehicle since 2012. And the way that they've been jamming throughout this run, like, anything seemed to be on the table at that point. A 45-minute Chalk Dust seemed to be on the table. It was a very good 25-minute jam with a particularly fantastic hood peak towards the end. I was situated behind the stage. First time I've ever been in that spot for a Phish show, and really enjoyed watching the crowd react to all the jamming in that, especially towards the end. But previous to that, you had hilarious Chocolate Rain opener, followed by Fishman standing at the microphones to deliver Ass Handed. Great Free. The Dogs always love to catch something off of Chillin' Thrilling. That was really great. A very, very good Divided Sky, then a Type 2 Sand that modulated and went into a major key and peaked really well, and that closed the set. And then following that, Chalk Dust Torture Jam in Set 2, debut of Hot Chocolate's You Sexy Thing, and then Mercury, my second Mercury I've ever seen. I love that song. My favorite 3.0 tune, probably my favorite Phish song since Sense and Subtle Sounds, and that found its way into a really interesting jam that went right back into You Sexy Thing. So really, really just great overall show. I don't know if it would sneak in the top 3 or top 4 of the run when all said and done, but if that was the only show that I saw on a summer tour, I'd be very, very pleased. Saturday night was kind of your classic Saturday rocker with a bit of a twist. I think, again, like Friday, if you caught that show on a random Saturday during summer 2016, the internet would be ablaze, that Fish is back, that everything's okay. We don't have to worry at all about Trey sneaking behind the Marimba Luminas.
Yeah, that's the thing that Beggars does, and even when it's not at its most robust, it's still very, very good by any other Fish standard.
Yeah.
So it's like pizza. Even when it's bad, it's good. I mean, bad being a relative term, but if you want to, I guess, like you say, even the worst night will stack up extremely favorably against anything from 2016.
Yeah, you know, I experienced this once before. Now, I would say that this last weekend that I saw was one of the strongest weekends of Fish I've ever seen, along with Dick's 2012 and Magnavol. Magnavol was strong all the way through. Dick's, you know, the Fuck Your Face show was on par with that 725 show that you saw. And the only reason I bring it up is when I go back now and I listen to 9-1, that's a very good show. And in a vacuum, that's a really, really good show. In the moment, I walked out slightly disappointed. And I know that...
You want that light?
The light was amazing. I had the venue looked as though they won the world, that we won the World Series. And I said it the morning after the Chalk Dust, that Chalk Dust was as close as I got to re-experiencing that feeling in a stadium with Fish fans, you know, from a jamming standpoint of just a huge peaking jam. My point is just sometimes Fish plays such a great show that no matter what they play the next night, it's always going to feel a bit underwhelming. And I think that you're seeing that with this past Saturday show, even Friday to a certain degree, Wednesday the 26th. There's just so much good jamming happening and so many good song selections and so many crazy debuts and so many rarities and bust outs that they're almost getting lost in the shuffle. And this is not me complaining. Keep it going, Fish. But it's the really interesting aspect of this. I mean, Saturday night opened up with a Llama and a Wilson that went 10 minutes into a deep jam. Yamar that kept flirting with Type 2 jamming. There was some really incredible energy in the Eye and the Walrus. You know, I felt immediately afterwards that was the best version of a Beatles song that had ever been played, and I was just blown away after I watched it. And then following it up in the second set with a really incredible Blaze On. I would say it is the Blaze On to this point. Great jam out of Meat Stick that perfectly faded into Dirt, a Type 2 Hood, and then, you know, just a ho-hum Cinnamon Girl encore, first time since 7/31/97. I mean, those sorts of things would just send the internet into a spiral on any given weekend of Fish, but right now is somewhat overlooked. And then Sunday, touched on it a bit earlier, I'll just say it again, I would say that's a top five Fish show I've ever seen. Curtain Width opener, really great, nearly Type 2 Runaway Jim. Some good, a really great playing on Home. I was glad to see that for the first time. And then ending the first set with Forbin's Squirming Coil Lyrics, Mockingbird, and David Bowie. And then set two, coming, starting off with 40 minutes of jamming out of Drowned and a song I heard the ocean sing. Always wanted to see a Type 2 version of that song. And to get as whacked out and as spacey of a version as they played was just a dream. And then to watch Trey look at Paige and have this shitty grin on his face and put his hands up to his face, and I just knew right then we're actually going to get a harpoon. Crowd lost it. Great narration about the origins of the universe. Following that with a really, really funky dance heavy 2001. And I guess I would probably have to say the best Golgi I've ever seen. The place was just on fire at that point.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever said that before, but it was just like that was
placements everything.
Placements everything. Sets, you know, exactly what you play during a set is everything. And then to encore with The Wind Cries Mary. I mean, I look back at the three encores I saw this weekend and could never have predicted those. That's not your typical Rocky Top or Character Zero encore. It's great, great stuff. So I think we've done this justice. There's a dozen. What we're going to do is we're going to play a bit of the tube. David's got some great stuff picked out for the tube, and then we're going to come back and chat just briefly about the song I Heard the Ocean Sing, and we'll play that, and hope you guys enjoy it.
Let's get to it.
Yeah.
Segment of the Tube Jam from July 26, 2017 from Madison Square Garden. That was the set closer of the fifth night of the Baker's Dozen. Now, you will note in that jam, there was a point where Page was playing these very big, bright D major piano chords. Fishman was doing a bit of a shuffle, and the whole thing was very danceable, very high step in, very bouncy mic bass line. And I'm going to use this as a segue to talk about a genre of music known as Madchester. That's Manchester, England, except mad. Now, picture, if you will, it's the summer of 1988 and the summer of 1989. Maybe you're a late teenager, early 20s. You're young and you're free and you're probably dancing at the Hacienda Club on lots and lots of ecstasy and perhaps LSD. Summer of 88 and also summer of 89 was sort of referred to as the second summer of love in Manchester, England. This was a time when many bands, as were known to be called the Madchester scene. These were bands that specialized in psychedelic music with big beats, big piano chords, very funky bass lines that led themselves to much freaky dancing, not unlike what you'd expect to see at a Fish show. The style of music has also been referred to as baggy, because the denizens often wore very big flared pants because they were comfortable. In addition to wearing these flared pants on the fashion sense, but also include like fishing hats. And you would kind of go to clubs like the Hacienda and the music would be booming. Things would be getting very hot and sticky with many strobe lights on the inside. If things would get too hot, you might take an ice pop, and you'd be listening to bands such as the Happy Mondays, the Charlatans, and Spiral Carpets, the Stone Roses. All of these bands specialized in dance beats, specialized in a brand of psychedelia, and I think the idea was you would take the MDMA, which I'm guessing was a lot purer back in 1989 than it is now, and go to these clubs and you would dance. So while the second summer of love was said to have, peaked in 1989, certainly the baggy style of music sort of permeated Brit rock throughout the early 90s and even kind of cracked the mainstream a little bit in 1991 or 1992 in slightly lamer form. Certainly the song Unbelievable by EMF, that's kind of an example of a baggy gone mainstream. He even had that band in 1992, Stereo MCs, with that Make Sure You're Connected, The Writing's on the Wall. Like, that song would even be considered somewhat of, mainstream baggy on MTV. And if you really want a fantastic overview of the Manchester scene that is far more entertaining and far better than anything I could tell you on a podcast, I would highly recommend that you watch the movie 24 Hour Party People, which is named after the first Happy Mondays record. It stars Steve Coogan in the guise of Tony Wilson, who is behind the Factory Records label. And it is just a fantastic overview of that era and everything leading up to that era. Endlessly rewatchable. One of my favorite movies of the past 20 years. I've probably seen it at least 15 times. And the first band, which I'm going to discuss in relates to this phenomenon, is the Happy Mondays. And the song we're going to play from them is called Step On. It's their signature song. It has very bright D major piano chords leading into a slinky bass line and the gruff creative vocals of one Sean William Ryder. The Happy Mondays did quite a bit of drugs, lots of ecstasy. As they went on, they unfortunately got into somewhat harder drugs. But what made them brilliant was, in addition to the very infectious dance beats, was the front man, Sean Ryder, who's a bit of a thuggish, gruff Mancunian, who came up with very, very witty wordplay. And it all came to a head on their peak album, 1990s Pills and Thrills and Belly Aches, which I would highly recommend to every last person listening to this podcast, as it is a glorious psychedelic dance album. This song comes from side B of that album. It is very danceable. It is very catchy. And the piano chords and the beat almost sound like they were taken wholesale from the portion of the Tube Jam, which I have just played for you right now. And, really, I think the best way to experience the Happy Mondays is just buy any one of their earlier records. I think they had four albums. I would highly recommend the Pills and Thrills album. I would recommend Bummed, which I believe came out in 1988. Their swan song, Yes Please, from 1992, wasn't that good because by that point they had all moved on to crack, which is not conducive to making music at all. But everything before then was pretty great. But I would recommend this song and this album quite highly. So we're going to play Step On with Happy Mondays.
Twisting my melon, man. You know he talks so hip, man. You're twisting my melon, man. Hey, Ray.
enjoyed songs Step On by the Happy Mondays. Normally, this would be the part in the show where Brian talks about a song, but I know the Manchester stuff better than he does, and he knows ambient way better than I do. So I'm going to take the next song. Going to play a song by a band called Primal Scream. The song is called Come Together. This was off of their 1991 album, Screamadelica. I believe it was their third album. And although this came a little bit after the height of the Manchester scene, it's still really considered to be one of the touchstones of it. It's much of the production is done by a man, Andrew Weatherall, who was a DJ who became very famous around that time. And this album, it has a lot of gospel, it has a lot of piano, a lot of harmony. It's very uplifting. It's the kind of song album when it comes on, certain songs like Come Together, Loaded, Moving On Up. You could just imagine people in the club raising their arms to the sky in jubilation, mostly because of the serious gospel influences on quite a bit of it. There's also some very good ballads. There's fantastic bass lines. And, you know, the whole thing is almost designed as a concept album of sorts. Like some songs, they get reprised. So what's interesting about Primal Scream is that if you know them, you might know them for their song Rocks from 1994, which was a Stones rip. Every one of their records is a bit different than the one that came before. They put out a record called Vanishing Point in the late 90s, which was very, very dub-oriented. They put out one in 2000 called Exterminator, which was lots of electronic noise, which featured Kevin Shields from My Bloody Valentine, was a member of the band at that point. So while they are an actual band, what they kind of tend to be is a cipher through whatever hot new producer they choose to put on the record at that point. So in 1991, this was their big baggy turn, and Screamadelica is thought as one of the best albums of that era and one of the best albums of Primal Scream's career. They're still around. Frontman Bobby Gillespie still putting on shows, putting out records of varying quality. This was probably as good as it got. So going to play Come Together by Primal Scream. We'll be right back. last song was Come Together by Primal Scream. And now for the third segment in the baggy portion, going to talk about one of my favorite bands, The Charlatans. And the song we're going to play is probably their biggest hit of the Manchester era, called The Only One I Know. Now, The Charlatans, they certainly got their start. Their first album came out in 1990. So while they were initially a fixture of the baggy scene, kind of as they went on, they became more traditional British rock, sort of more Rolling Stones, you could say. Sometimes people lobbied things against them, say they were kind of knockoff artists. In particular, the song which we're going to play here sounds a heck of a lot like Hush by Deep Purple. But they're fantastic songwriters. They probably peaked in 1997 with their album Telling Stories, but they've put out, goodness, they have at least 10 or 11 studio albums. They're still around today. They're still putting out very good songs. And, you know, with their frontman, Tim Burgess, is a charismatic guy, and they've always kind of specialized in a very bright, classic version of dance music. So the Charlatan song I'm going to play now is The Only One I Know. And again, it's evocative of the baggy era in terms of the big beats, big organ, and the psychedelic catchiness, and sounds quite a bit like this tube jam. So here it comes.
Jamming similarities between Happy Mondays, Primal Scream, and The Charlatans with that tube jam. I heard it completely. Really, really enjoyed that. So at this point in the show, we're going to take a bit of a pause here and talk a bit about new albums. I will be, full disclosure, completely honest with you all right now. Ever since Fish Tour started, I have really fallen out of my new album rotations. It's probably the only thing I'm excited about the Baker's Dozen ending is a bit of a break from listening to Fish every day and starting to dive back into new music. I don't know if you're the same way, but.
Oh, I do. 100%.
So I'm digging a little bit deep into my yearly rotation here. This is a record that came out in May, but I keep listening to, I keep enjoying, and I keep hearing more sounds and great songwriting out of it every time I listen to it. This is Wooden Wands Clipper Ship. This is James Jackson Toll's first record since 2014. And really, at the end of the day, this just ticks off a lot of boxes for me. It's woozy acoustic guitars that are layered, psych folk solos, patience is rewarded, you get Sun Kill Moon as songwriting about the mundane aspects of life. Really, for me, that's what I look for in a lot of songwriting and a lot of music right now. The song Mexican Coke kind of summarizes the record. It's a song about bygone pleasure of carrying around cash, particularly when it comes to wasting away time in restaurants where Mexicans Coke is served and presumably is cash only. There's a line in it, there's no use using all the unused dollars down the line. You can't stockpile time. What has the night to do with sleep when there are promises to keep? Which really, really displays the nuanced beauty of the record. A lot of great figures of speech, a lot of great kind of lines that come together over four or five phrases. And it's just a really pretty record that just kind of sits with you for a long time. Unlike what he had done in the past, Toth wrote the melodies to these songs prior to writing the lyrics. So throughout the whole record is a very, very heavy soundscape feel to the songs. The lyrics in that case sometimes fit in non-traditionally, which I really enjoy. And it's a record that really rewards multiple listens. Toth gives his backing musicians a ton of freedom throughout the record. So they dabble from measure to measure, and they provide the listener with, you know, these kind of little Easter eggs and just numerous surprises with each repeated listen. It's one of those albums that, you know, you hear a song the first time, you kind of hear the overlying melody, and then you hear it four or five, six more times, and you start to hear a drummer in the background who just kind of takes the rhythm and the beat off into a different direction for, you know, just a slight second, or a guitar riff that's, you know, underlying the overall song that you never caught before, or just some kind of offhanded noise. And we referenced and discussed William Tyler's Modern Country back in episode 5 when we talked about the Alpine Tweezer. Fans of that record, I think, would greatly enjoy this. And Glenn Cochee, the drummer for Wilco, appears on both records, and something about his very atmospheric drumming that fits perfectly to this sound as well as that of Modern Country. So Wooden Wands, Clipper Ship, I would definitely recommend listening to this record, especially as we start to enter the hazy finality of summer and move into fall. I think it's going to be one of those records that I'm just going to want to listen to on repeat come late September, early October. What do you got, Dave?
So a new album that I have been spending some time with is the new one by Nicole Atkins, Goodnight Rhonda Lee. Now, Nicole Atkins has sort of become somewhat more famous than when the jam band said from her frequent sit-ins with Joe Russo's Almost Dead playing the Donna role, because she, give her credit, she knows her dead and sings her songs extremely well. But she's also an excellent solo artist in her own right. And her latest album, and the first that she's made since she moved to Nashville, relocated there from Asbury Park, New Jersey, it really showcases the fact that at her heart, she's a soul singer. The album that came out before that a few years ago, Slow Phaser, was kind of, it was enjoyable, but it was sort of lukewarm indie rock, some questionable flirtations with disco, some sort of almost Brit rock textures. New one is pure Stax. I know that she recorded it with the drummer Josh Block and guitarist Austin Jenkins, both of whom left the Austin band White Denim to sort of go into more soul-based production work. I know that they were the rhythm section for the singer Leon Bridges, and they've kind of branched out since then. But, you know, the album, in addition to her pipes, it's very, very warm production. It's got good horn charts. It's got some good organ work. You know, it just sounds very warm and lived in. And I think going like the full soul route is probably one of the better ideas that she's had in some time. I know that she has some really good co-writers on her songs. I know that that Chris Isaak, I think, contributes to at least two songs on the record, including the first single, A Little Crazy, which is the opening track. And it's a very impressive album so far, and I'm definitely looking to see her when she comes back to New York City in September, I think. She's playing the Mercury Lounge. That should be a great show. And now, from there, I just want to transition into the next jam, which we are going to be talking about, which is a song I heard the Ocean sing from the most recent Sunday night show, which would have been July 30th, 2017.
Darkness deep. Run away, run away, run away, run away. I pray the prayer into the tide. Run away, run away, run away, run away. And both they soothe me in my sleep. For every season that has passed, I pray the prayer.
Alright, so quickly just covering the song I heard the ocean sing from Sunday, July 30th. This really couldn't have been more different from the Tube Jam that we discussed earlier. And kind of one of the reasons that we decided to go with two jams. Well, in part, the quantity of jamming at the Baker's Dozen makes it really, really difficult to pick and choose. But also just the diversity that they're jamming with right now is just... I don't know if I'd say it's unprecedented, but it's definitely unprecedented in the last 15 years, at least since 2.0, but this reminds me a little bit more of what was happening towards the latter end of 1.0. But from my money, this is the perfect jam. I don't know if there's anything more that I want from Phish than this kind of deep space, off-kilter, slightly electronic, slightly acid jazz, feeling like UFOs are landing in the middle of Midtown Manhattan. I mean, this was just a absolutely epic jam to witness. I've listened back to it now a couple of times, and it holds up extremely well on tape. What are your thoughts on this one, Dave?
Yeah, I watched this on a Sony flat screen TV in the basement of this rental house that my family has in Cape Cod for a week, sitting on a couch next to a wooden table made to look like a whale, because it is Cape Cod after all. And I just said, wow, I need to listen to this set again as soon as possible, perhaps under the influence of something fun. And it took the Nassau Twist Jam, the classic April 2nd, 1998, aliens landing on Space Jam, to a logical, just extremes, especially the middle of the song. I heard the Ocean Sing jam. It's almost broken down to the point where it sounds like it's from summer 1995. They just totally throw out the song structure and get skronky with it. There's a lot of space, and it's completely different than the Tube Jam. It's completely different than the major key blitz and get enough of in the first week in a Baker's Dozen. And, you know, it just shows the degree of the looseness and the staggering high quality of these shows that they're willing to go on a limb and do this. And it also, you know, it gives them a very high opinion of their audience, that the audience is willing to come with.
Yeah. Yeah. It shows kind of the patience that they've gotten into this deep into the run. And you're absolutely right. It's kind of a tip of the cap to their fan base on a Sunday night. One thing I noticed on re-listen, it sounds as though they're yelling Jimmy a couple of times throughout the jam. Trey was definitely doing some vocal stuff, and I just kind of love that little throw in there to the gag and to the donuts. And I mean, overall, I loved this jam, the way it faded into our poo. One thing I loved about this jam was that three or four different times you thought it was coming to an end. And every time I thought it was coming to an end, I was like, well, that's as far out as I've heard a song near the ocean sing go in, 6 years now? I'm pretty satisfied. And then they would come back in with something. And that's kind of where Fish is at right now. It's a good place to be.
Would agree 100%. And on that note, let's listen to some of it.
Thank you.
you enjoyed a bit of that trippy jamming from the song I Had the Ocean Sing on July 30th, 2017. So as Dave mentioned, his forte is Madchester from the late 80s, early 90s. I'm a huge fan of ambient experimental noise-based music, so we felt it was great to each of us pick a jam that we saw, pick a style of music that we are both pretty passionate about for this. So I'm going to talk about three artists that I think everyone here who is a Phish fan that likes what they played, especially during that Drowned and A Song I Heard the Ocean Sing, as well as Set 2 of 723, and I would say portions of the Chalked Earth, Cross-Eyed and Painless from 725, about 19 minutes in, 19, 20 minutes in, when they went into a very deep, ambient, beatless sort of section. And, you know, really just some of these peak ambient jammings from this tour. If you enjoyed that, I think that you would really like the three artists we're going to talk about. And the first one we're going to go with is a guy by the name of Tim Hecker, who I've been trying to figure out an excuse to talk about on this podcast since we started. And I'm really glad that coming out of that, A Song I Heard the Ocean Sing, it was really the first artist I thought of. And we're going to play a song off of his 2013 record, Virgins. The song is called Live Room. So Tim Hecker is an L.A. artist by way of Montreal. He can be kind of personified as an electronic, noise, ambient, and just kind of overall experimental artist. The current sounds that he focuses on, they really highlight his use of pipe organs played in a live setting that are then broken down, disjointed, and rebuilt through editing and through further work from a production standpoint. It's really, really interesting sound that has a very authentic but atmospheric and kind of postmodern sound to it. Hecker came from two art teachers, his parents. After college, before going into playing music, he worked as a Canadian political analyst for the Canadian government.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
That was a new little nugget of information I got for myself in preparing for this. Kind of makes sense when I take into account his music, and kind of fits the theme of the current Phish show that's happening right now. This record, Virgins, was the seventh LP. It was just brilliant. This was a top 10 record for me in 2013. This was recorded in Seattle, Reykjavik, Iceland, and Troy, New York, of all places. Much of it, though, was recorded in a church in Iceland, where it was recorded live, allowing the space to shape the music rather than the typical reverse pattern for electronic music. This is a very sublime headphones record. The song we're going to play here, Live Room, is the complete peak of the album. And aside from Hatred of Music and the Piano Drop Trilogy, which was on 2011's Rave Death 1972, another fantastic record of his, really the peak of Hecker's sound, I would say, overall. We're going to talk about another artist here after we play Live Room, named Owen Trix Point Never, who is the stage name of Daniel Lopatin, who Hecker has worked with in the past on a few improvisational projects, specifically over the last few years. So he's definitely worked his way around the noise, the ambient, and electronic scene in kind of a larger indie rock and noise-based world. From a really general sense, you know, his music, I would say, proves the worth of watching art fall apart and fade away in front of your eyes. A lot of his songs are kind of meant to be destructed and meant to fall apart, not really build anything. They're meant to show you a sound, show you an idea, and then kind of waste that all away. And think Godspeed You Black Emperor, Fenizes, who we covered in episode 6 when we discussed, it was episode 7 when we discussed the Jones Beach Bowie, Kid A era Radiohead, as well as William Baczynski, who we did feature in episode 6 when we talked about the Fukuoka twist. So we're going to focus on or play a sample of the song Live Room here off of Virgins. This is Tim Hecker. Tim Hecker's Virgins. We're going to transition here and talk about the Daniel Lopatin fronted project Owen Tricks Point Never. And this is off of his 2015 release Garden of Delete, the song Child of Rage. Owen Tricks Point Never, or OPN for short, is an electronic and experimental based artist in Brooklyn, who records on the Warp label. The name Owen Tricks Point Never is a audible play on the Boston radio station Magic 106.7. He's been making music as OPN since 2007, when he moved from Massachusetts down to New York. And interestingly, he is the son of Russian Jewish immigrants who immigrated during the Soviet Union, both of whom were musicians. He started experimenting with music because of his dad's jazz fusion record collection and the Roland Juno 60 synth that his dad had at home, which he still records with and he still uses on stage. He moved to Brooklyn for grad school. He was studying archival science and from there got involved in the Brooklyn noise scene that was developing in the early to mid 2000s. And has been steadily putting out records on a 2 to 3 year basis since about 2009. In 2014, he toured in support of Nine Inch Nails and Soundgarden, a huge opportunity for him to be the opening act for those two artists. And the album that we're discussing here, the song we're discussing off of the album, 2015, Garden of Delete, was inspired following this tour where in which Trent Reznor told him to just play as hard as he wanted during the opening set. He wanted to get the audience as amplified and as slightly terrified as possible. And so he really went kind of as hard as he possibly could throughout his opening slots, and then would spend the rest of the night listening to Soundgarden and Nine Inch Nails, which inspired him to revisit the grunge scene that he was raised on, which led him to think a lot about adolescence and puberty, which he remembered as a pretty traumatic experience, which was then reflected in his music. This record he wrote and recorded, well, he wrote it in a small windowless basement apartment in Brooklyn that he rented immediately following the tour, and then started recording it shortly thereafter. The record was preceded by a really intense promo campaign, which in turn helped to become his most anticipated record yet. There was a fake website at one point that was put up, a lot of crazy articles that were put up. I swear it was not as annoying as the Everything Now record release.
But, just gonna say that.
proof that you can take a kind of atypical and intense approach to promoting your record, and if it's really good music, people will appreciate it. So unlike Tim Hecker, we talked about just a little bit ago, this record and most of what OPN does is not the most inviting sound. I will fully admit that it challenges the listener to pay attention and follow Lopatin's constant shifts. It can almost feel like there's just like an ADD tendency to the music, and almost reminds me in some cases of Summer 1995 Phish, where they'd just be jamming this very intense style, and then they'd come across a melody, and it was almost as though they were afraid of getting into something that was really pleasant and really peaceful, and so they'd immediately move into something a little bit more aggressive and intense. And it feels like that sometimes here. That said, and for me, you know, I don't listen to this on a regular basis. I'll listen to it when I'm in the mood, and it, you know, definitely will hit me very hard when I do hear it. If you can bear the constant movement, it's a very deeply engaging record, full of lots of emotional payoffs, especially come out of subject matter and really just the technical skill of Daniel Lopatin with his OPN recording. So we're going to listen to Child of Rage off of Owen Tricks Point Never's Garden of Delete. Thank you. that you enjoyed Child of Rage there, and hope that it kind of brought back memories of the song I Heard the Ocean Sing from July 30th. The last song, the last band that we're going to discuss is yet again another one of those bands I've been looking for an excuse to fit into the podcast. Fits here perfectly. This is Boards of Canada, with the song Reach for the Dead off of 2013's Tomorrow's Harvest, their first record in, I believe, 7 years at that point. A really big deal, really big record of 2013, and one of my favorite records that year. So Boards of Canada are a Scottish electronic duo, brothers Michael Sanderson and Marcus Ion Sanderson, have been recording since the mid-1980s, I want to say, and they record in this very warm, very analog sound that is a mimicking of a lot of media and a lot of production work in the 1970s. They are constantly exploring themes of childhood and of nostalgia, and this is a very, very reclusive band. They rarely give interviews. They rarely even play live. Their last known live show was 2001's All Tomorrow's Parties. So this is a group that if you hear from them, it does not necessarily mean that you are going to see them. In anticipation of Tomorrow's Harvest coming out, a record that had been kind of rumored to be in production and be in existence from around 2010-2011, but again, no real press, nothing really behind it. They sent an unlabeled vinyl to the Other Music Record Store in New York City for Record Store Day in 2013.
Rest in peace.
It contained a brief snippet of music that was confirmed to be by them by their label Warp. Over the next few months, snippets of announcements came on platforms like BBC, various websites, even Adult Swim, about the album, about codes pertaining to the record. And then finally, fans were invited to visit a website where there was a 6-digit code that fans needed to enter. Those who entered it correctly were allowed in, where the album cover first emerged. And the album cover is actually really interesting. It was taken, it's a picture of the San Francisco city skyline with a few of the buildings reversed and put in different places. It's taken from an Air Force base, and there's just this kind of thick cloud that lingers over the skyline. And it looks as though kind of looking at a post-apocalyptic city. It toys with, you know, again, the skyline of San Francisco makes it look almost like a city that you'd find in Southeast Asia. It's just really, really fitting for the sound of the overall record and for the sound of where Boards of Canada is here now, you know, 30 years into their career. The album overall was influenced very heavily by film soundtracks of the 1970s. And was, like I said earlier, one of my favorite records of 2013. I think it was a top 10 or top 15 record for me of the year. And this song, Reach for the Dead, really introduced the album in a really beautiful way. And we are going to go ahead and listen to that right now. Thank you.
folks. Just want to recap the songs that you heard on this episode. Now, in terms of discussing the Tube Jam from July 26, 2017, we played Happy Mondays, Step On, Primal Scream, Come Together, and The Charlatans, The Only One I Know. Those are our examples of jamming based upon the Manchester scene of 1989 in Manchester, England. And then for the version of the song I heard the ocean sing from this past Sunday, July 30th, that was our Midtown UFOs section. We listened to Tim Hecker, Live Room, Oniontrix, Point Never, Child of Rage, and Boards of Canada, Reach for the Dead.
And just a quick reminder of where you guys can find us online. We are on Twitter at underscore beyond the pond. We are on Medium. We publish a brief essay ahead of the release of our episodes at medium.com/beyond the pond. And we have been updating our Spotify playlist with each of the songs that we feature. If there's a Fish Jam that is on Spotify, we put that on there as well. But definitely the songs that we've been selecting, and that playlist has gotten pretty diverse and pretty robust. Definitely recommend listening to that and throwing that on shuffle. So those are the big places that you guys can find us and interact with us and add us and tell us everything that we do incorrectly and say incorrectly about Fish, and how the connections that we make just simply cannot be right.
No, never right.
Never right.
Just to go over our publishing structure, what we do is we publish every other Tuesday, so twice a month, once every 2 weeks. This episode is going to run just after the Baker's Dozen has concluded on, I believe, August 8th. It is every other Tuesday because we say that Tuesdays suck because they have no feel. But I think I'm going to have to call it into question after having witnessed what took place on Tuesday, July 25th.
Absolutely.
And on that note, I'm David Goldstein.
I'm Brian Brinkman.
And please come back again in 2 weeks and join us as together we go beyond the pond.
Throughout the night, when there's no direct light, and a thin veil of clouds keeps the stars out of sight, I can smell the colors outside on my lawn, the moist green organic that my feet tread upon, and the black oleander surrounded by blue.